Well, good morning, church. It is good to be with you all again. I appreciate you all braving the blizzard-like conditions this morning. Shows your dedication this morning that you brave these difficult conditions. I know the elders were contemplating canceling services this morning. They held off. I appreciate that. I tell you what, I got to be at Upward Basketball yesterday, and I know there were other ball games going on in town as well. My wife was at some of those. Just real quick, we're going to do this really informally. If you played basketball yesterday, stand up. Just stand up if you played basketball yesterday. Come on. Oh, there's more than that. All right, well, stay standing. If you worked at a ball game yesterday, organizing, coaching, announcing, refereeing, concession stand, popcorn, setup, cleanup, if you worked at a ball game yesterday, stand up. All right, if you attended a ball game yesterday, like went as a parent or grandparent or just to cheer people on yesterday, stand up. Or if you cheered at a basketball game yesterday, stand up. Oh, thank you guys so much. You know, church, y'all can sit down. We come together over Jesus, but I'm thinking basketball is close second. There was all kinds of ball going on yesterday, and this is the third Upward League that my family has been a part of. This is the fourth Upward League my family has been a part of. My son was in two different ones. I tell you what, you've got to work hard to get kicked out of an Upward League. But we did it. One of the parents was coaching a little from the sideline. That's not entirely true. All right. And then my daughter played a year of upward ball, a season of upward ball at a different church. And they were all good experiences. I would say positive things about all of those organizations, all of those congregations that work so diligently, put those together. And I say this as unbiasedly as I can. Our Upward League is the best I have ever seen, like far and away. Y'all, give them a hand. Give those people a hand. I mean, it is top down. It's the best organized. It has, consistent coaches who kind of know what they're doing and know the kids and know what they're trying to accomplish. The announcing, the free popcorn up and down the aisles, the concession stand is run well. The cleanup goes. It doesn't become a pigsty during the day. It's because people are paying attention to those sorts of things. The director is making sure everybody is where they need to be when they need to be. It is just so well done, and those kids and families appreciate it. I'm here to tell you. You guys do a great job with that, and I do not have any basketball talent at all. I tried out for the basketball team. I was on every basketball team that you didn't have to try out to be on, but once I got into school and you had to try out to be on the basketball game, I tried out in seventh grade. I didn't make the team, and tried out in eighth grade, and I didn't make the team. And by the way, these were teams that won two games in 2 years. I mean, it wasn't like I didn't make the Chicago Bulls or anything. I mean, this was just. And then I tried out in ninth grade, and I made it, but largely because fewer kids tried out. But I made the team, sort of. We had 16 guys on our team. And 15 uniforms. So me and another guy took turns wearing the. I'm not even making this up. I sort of made the team, and I went to every game, and I got to play it once. And anyway, so yeah, I have no basketball talent whatsoever. I didn't learn to shoot a free throw until we got married, and Rebecca and I were living in a gym. And she taught me to shoot a free throw because we didn't have television, because we went in the gym and shot free throws. And I remember that ninth grade year, though, when I made the team. Like, I was excited that I had made the basketball team. And I play basketball like a football player. If you need somebody tackled, put me in. I'm an excellent fouler. And so I was nonetheless proud that I had made the team that year. And so at the end of the school, or at the end of the season, we went to one of my good friends. He was kind of hosting an end of the season party, and he invited several guys from the basketball team over and some different just kind of friends. But it was kind of end of the basketball season shindig, no big or anything. But I remember being there because that was one of my most traumatic moments. I remember I was being there, and one of the guys that I was friends with on the basketball team, he was also the quarterback on our football team, so I was a lineman for him as well in football. And this guy and I were friends. Like, we'd always gotten along. We had some classes together. We were just, we weren't best buddies or anything, but we were friends. And I remember I was playing pool at this party, and I heard this girl behind me. She was a year older than us, but she was real good-looking girl, and she said something, and then she started laughing, and he joined in. And I turned around and said, "What's so funny?" And I found out that they were making fun of me. And it was not the fact of her, because I didn't really know her, and I didn't really care for her anyway, other than the fact that she was a girl, and I like girls. I didn't really know her in particular, but the fact that my friend had joined in was pretty painful. Like, this was somebody that I liked and I thought liked me, and it just was really, really painful. His name was Cody Gildon. So if you ever meet Cody Gildon, you can tell him I said I'm coming for him. Not really. So have you ever felt betrayed by someone? If you have felt betrayed by someone, just raise your hand. I would say most of us have, haven't we? You loved them, you trusted them, even explicitly, only have them sort of turn on you. Do you remember what that felt like? If it's ever happened to you, then I'll bet you remember what it feels like, because that's not one you'd kind of forgot about. Oh yeah, I forgot I was betrayed by someone I loved. Right? You remember what it feels like in that moment, or in the moments that followed as well. What are some words that we might use to describe how that made us feel? What are some words we might use? Might use to describe that? Just shout one out. Anybody? Devastated. Heartbroken. Oh, good ones. Yep. Blah blah blah. What words we might use to describe? What's that? The word betrayed. We feel betrayed. Anger? Anybody else angry? Man, yeah, I was angry. Humiliated. Oh, that's a good one. Alone? Like, it really makes you feel isolated. There's a lot of words we might use to describe this feeling of being betrayed. When we're betrayed by someone we love, it hurts. Like, it hurts. I would argue that it is one of the most pains we could go through in life, to be betrayed by someone we love. And we go through some really difficult things, but this is one of the most emotionally painful. It is an emotional wound that for some is terminal. Like, it drives them the rest of their life steadily towards an early grave. They just cannot let that go because it's so, so painful. Betrayal is so hurtful that even when it isn't us, like when it happens to someone else that we know or someone else that we love, we feel their anger and their pain and their resentment, right? We long to lash out on their behalf. It doesn't even have to happen to us. We can just see it happening to someone else. It could even be someone you don't know. If you were sitting in a restaurant and you overhear the conversation at the next table between a young man and a young woman, and you find out that he has been unfaithful in their marriage and is leaving her, you would feel for her, and you don't know her from Eve, right? Betrayal is that sort of pain. So maybe that's why, more than any other name, we despise the name of Judas. We despise that name. One of the 12 apostles. I know guys named Peter. I know guys named John or Thomas or Andrew or Simon or Matthew or Philip. I even know a Thaddeus and a Bartholomew. But I don't know a single Judas. Nobody in their right mind would name their little boy Judas any more than they would name their sweet little girl Jezebel. Well, nobody in their right mind, let's put it that way, right? The name Judas is so despised that it has become a noun separate and apart from the formal proper noun, the name Judas. You can be a Judas even though your name is not Judas. You can be a Judas, right? Someone can be a Judas. It's used as a noun to describe anyone that cannot be trusted to be loyal or faithful. If I were you, I wouldn't go into business with that guy. He's a Judas. I wouldn't date her. She's a Judas. Right? We understand what that means. Even though we don't really literally think their name is Judas, we know what a Judas is. But this morning, we come to John's account of Judas's betrayal of Jesus. And it is my hope and it is my prayer this morning that we'll begin to see his actions in light and the response of Jesus in a new light. And maybe, just maybe, we'll find our story somewhere in this one. Because I believe it's relevant for all of us. Your Bibles, you want to open them up to John chapter 18. Be reading and focusing on verses 1 through 9 this morning. John 18 through 9, if you got your cell phone app or your iPad or whatever you use to read Scripture on, you're welcome to go ahead and open it up there and leave it there all day. Let's start by just reading verse 1. John chapter 18, verse 1. When he, Jesus, had finished praying, I was alluding back to chapter 17, the high priestly prayer that we went through back in December that Jesus was praying. When he finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron. And on the other side, there was a garden. Didn't they name the garden? It's the Garden of Gethsemane. We learn from other gospel accounts. But there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Quick note on the geography here. The Kidron is sometimes called a valley, sometimes called a brook. It is really a dry stream bed, except in winter. When they got all the rain, and during the winter, when all the rain came through, it would be a little stream. The rest of the time, it lays dry. We might even call it like a gut, something like that. It was just outside of Jerusalem, so it was outside the city. This is the Passover. Remember, this is the time of the Passover. By law, Jews were supposed to spend the night inside Jerusalem for the Passover. I mean, that was their law. If you've come to Passover, you're supposed to spend the night in Jerusalem. Why wasn't Jesus spending the night in Jerusalem? Well, what had happened by this time was that the population of returning Jews so large, you couldn't get everybody in the city. So for a few special days surrounding the feast days, they sort of extended the city. They said, Jerusalem is not just within the walls, it also extends all the way out to here and here, really all the way out to the Mount of Olives, which is where Jesus and his disciples were. And this particular valley, the Kidron Valley that they're passing through, was famous for being the place where the foreign idols were brought to be burned and their altars destroyed. If you go back and you read the account in 2 Kings and Chronicles, and over again, you have that when a righteous king came into office and they wanted to rid the land of idolatry and they cleaned house, they would take all of that idolatry trash down to the Kidron Valley. They burn up the wood parts and smash the stone parts. So if you think about it, Jesus, who is walking towards his death, and as he is quite literally being covered by the dust of the people's sins. Their betrayal of the covenant with his father litters his person. Let's keep reading now. Verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Pause right there. John uses a word here that none of the other gospel accounts uses when referring to this group of soldiers. It's the word detachment in this particular translation. A Roman detachment would have been 1/10 of a legion, or about 1,000 soldiers. It was supposed to be right out of it. In practice, it was usually closer to 600. That's the way it usually worked out. So I don't know what you had envisioned coming for Jesus in the night, torches and lanterns, but I probably didn't have 600 armed soldiers in my brain. Why would so many? Why? They're coming after one guy who's never hurt anybody. What is the deal here? What is going on? Why are they carrying these torches and lanterns and weapons? What's all the fuss? By the way, you would think Passover was on a full moon. So they normally, if they're just going out to look around, they don't need torches. They don't need lanterns because you can see by the full moon. So what's going on here with all the torches and lanterns and weapons? Well, remember that this was a hotbed of activity in the Roman Empire. They'd had a rebellious activity. And so during Jewish feast days, soldiers from across the empire would be stationed in and around Jerusalem, particularly just outside the temple there. Thousands and thousands of extra Roman soldiers around to keep the peace, because you've got hundreds and thousands of Jews in one place. What if they decide to start a revolt? You better be ready, right? So there's all of these soldiers around. They find out that one of these guys is a rebel rouser, that he's been instigating problems amongst the people. And so, based on the testimony of Jewish and these Jewish leaders, Jesus is starting a revolt, hence the weapons. And again, because they're coming, now they're all coming. It's not a group. This is not, you know, spies or anything like that. You hear 1,000 people marching with swords and armor at you. That's not a secret. So they fully expected him to do what? Run and hide. And when they come into the Garden of Gethsemane, even though there's a full moon, there's going to be pockets and corners where there's deep shade and shadow. They need to be able to track down a fugitive. And so this army or this contingent of soldiers, detachment of soldiers, plus the rest of the party are ready for a confrontation of some sort. Beginning at verse 4, or continuing at verse 4, we read, Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen, went out and asked them, "Who is it?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas, as we're told for a second time, Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they went back and fell to the ground. So they expect a manhunt, or they expect an armed confrontation. Instead, Jesus walks out, apparently by himself, to go and meet them and talk with them, and he begins questioning them. They're thinking they're going to have to arrest him and drag him back into the city for questioning, and he walks out to them and starts questioning them. Not what's expected. And when they tell him that they're seeking Jesus of Nazareth, or Jesus the Nazarene, is the literal word used here, notice Jesus' response, "I am he," except that's not literally what he says. You want to guess what he literally says? "I am. I am." As in the literal name of the Hebrew God, I am. The unpronounceable, unutterable name of God. It is the words of a deity. You didn't respond that way to a question. Nobody does. It was just a phrase you didn't use. You worked your way around it with different words and different phrases because nobody speaks those words. That's the name of God that we don't say. It's a secret. It is reverent and it is holy. We give it that due distance. And the boldness and authority with which Jesus speaks takes this crowd aback. And so John records they all just fall to the ground in response. Not the normal response of a detachment confronting a traitor or someone they believe is a rebel. It's almost like all of that military might powerless in the face of God. The best armed, best trained soldiers in the world were powerless in the face of an unarmed man, unless you know the man was God. So unlike the other gospel accounts, John is going out of his way to demonstrate that Jesus was not being dragged off by his heels to prison, that Jesus the entire time is completely in control. Jesus is not just some innocent martyr who died a good death. Jesus was someone, he was God who was choosing to put his life on the line. He knew it was coming. He went out to meet it, and he boldly confronted it. All right, continuing at verse 7. We'll read through the rest of our reading this morning. Again, he asked, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he." Same words. Literally, "I am." "I told you that I am." "If you're looking for me, then these men go." The other disciples are now with him. And he points back to them and says, "Let these men go." And John explains why this happened, so that the words he had spoken will be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those you gave me." By taking this way, Jesus has effectively directed everybody's attention on himself, right? He's gone out and he started questioning them. He's leading the discussion. Everybody is focused on Jesus. And so normally what would happen is they would swoop in and they would net the whole bunch and get the big fish out. What happened to the little fish? Who cares what happens to them? But now by doing it the way he did it, Jesus has shielded, has protected these men who are with him. He said, "Ask them, who are you seeking?" And they said, "We're seeking Jesus of Nazareth." And he tells them, "That's me. These guys are not Jesus of Nazareth. So you can let them go." Now, years later, sometimes short years later, these exact same disciples are going to be facing some very similar circumstances in which a hostile crowd and those in authority are seeking not Jesus of Nazareth, but his disciples now, and especially these particular men. And so why? Jesus knows they're going to be put in this circumstance later. Why would he protect them now? I mean, they're going to have to face it eventually. Why protect now? It's because their faith wasn't strong enough yet. At this point, physical arrest and brutality had a very serious and grave danger, posed a very serious and grave danger to their spiritual faith, their spiritual health. It would likely have cost them the little faith they'd come by. So Jesus says, in this tremendous act of selflessness, and he offers himself up as a way of protecting them. And by the way, this looks back at the prayer we just read in John 17. Remember when Jesus spoke in his prayer, he says that "I will not lose any of them." And he speaks this, by the way, throughout the book of John over and over. This is a phrase. It's John 10. You may remember the story of the good shepherd who looks after the sheep. And the good shepherd 11 says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. That is exactly what's happening right here. "These are my sheep. Let them go. I am the shepherd. You can have me." So, what's really amazing about Jesus' actions here, this is all pretty amazing, but probably stuff you largely already knew. What's really amazing to me about Jesus' actions here is that he's doing this selfless act in the midst of being betrayed by a man he loves. Do you remember how you felt when you were betrayed? Did anybody throw out the word selfless? Sacrificial? Did anybody throw out the word giving? No. It's not how I felt when I was being betrayed. Not at all. And Jesus doesn't lash out. He doesn't avoid the conflict with these soldiers, doesn't avoid the conflict with Judas. He faces it boldly and steps forward to embrace the betrayal instead. Jesus doesn't walk away. He doesn't run away. He doesn't run to a fight. He just walks up and embraces the betrayal. In the other gospel accounts, quite literally to a kiss. Knowing it's coming, full face, Jesus embraces the betrayal. These men have come to rest and mutilate an innocent man, and he never backs down. And as angry as this makes you and me, and as angry as this makes Simon Peter, we'll learn in the next couple of verses when he whips out a sword and cuts off Malchus's ear, as angry as it makes us, this in this particular story, you and me, we're not Jesus. We're everyone else. We aren't the betrayed. We're the betrayers. And on this, John is very clear. Now, I know what you're thinking, because I thought the same thing too. There is no way I would ever betray Jesus. I am loyal. I am faithful. I would be like Peter and defend Jesus. That's the way I am. I mean, you say, well, some people, even though good people, might turn their back on Jesus. Not me. I would never do that. That's not who I am. So I can see myself maybe in Peter, but not in Judas, which is interesting. About five verses later, we find out that Peter betrays Jesus and denies he knew him. You see, the point that John is making is not that Judas is a particularly bad guy and or bad friend, and that Peter is a particularly good friend. The point is that both friends and enemies of the cross all deny and betray Jesus. Everyone is guilty of that. And maybe you are loyal. Maybe you are faithful. Maybe you are strong. But I'll bet you don't have to think too long to remember a time that you weren't. You remember a time you weren't loyal to Jesus? You weren't faithful to Jesus? That your faith wasn't as strong as it feels right now on a beautiful Sunday morning, sitting in the midst of brothers and sisters in Christ who love you right after having a great sin and a great time of devotion to the Lord's Supper and a wonderful prayer and elders who are leading and guiding us spiritually. Man, this is fantastic. But I'll tell you that this is not my experience 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Sometimes we're weak, aren't we? A time maybe that you weren't as powerful in the Lord as you feel right now. A time when you were weak and weary, when you were lost and alone. A time when you were like Peter. A time when you were like Judas. But the point of this story is not merely that we're all going to betray Jesus. I mean, that's almost self-evident at this point. The point is that Jesus knows that we're going to betray him, and he still chooses to shelter and protect us in the palm of his hand. Jesus knows that Peter's going to deny him, and still he offers himself up on his behalf. Jesus knew that Judas was going to betray him, and yet he still walked into that kiss. Jesus knows that you and I are as untrustworthy as a dog with a foamy mouth. And he still, I don't know where I got this going, oh my word. He knows we're untrustworthy, and yet he still walks forward to offer himself up. He knows it, and he still chooses to lay his life down on our behalf. He knows it, and yet he still asks them Who is it you want? That's the same question he asks you and me this morning. Who is it you want? And even though we know we're guilty, you know you're guilty. I know I'm guilty. Even though we know we've betrayed him, even though we know we don't deserve it, Jesus asks, who is it you want? And he longs for us to look him in the eye and tell him face to face, Jesus of Nazareth. I want Jesus of Nazareth. Maybe I don't act like it right now. Maybe I haven't lived like it in the past. Maybe I'll forget in the future. But I want Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus knows and loves you anyway. And if you are not a child of God, if you've not put on Jesus Christ in baptism, had your sins washed away, if you've not given your life to him to live in the footsteps of a man like this, become a father, be the child of a father like that, then we want to welcome you to the family this morning, to bring you in and make you a part of ours. If we can help you at all, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
To Lord, nor to defend his cause, maintain the honors of his word, the glory of his cross. Firm as his throne, his promise stands, and he can well secure what I've committed to his hands till the decisive hour. Then will he own my worthless name before his Father's face, and in the new